This is Just Another Wine Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Jamie Good.
And I'm Doug Gregg.
Today we're talking about the appellation system and appellations as a whole. Appellations serve as possibly a great benefit for consumers to understand or get used to particular styles, regions, grape varieties, to have potentially know what they can expect from a bottle of wine. However, that comes with several limitations that could inhibit creativity, varietal expression, maybe even terroir expression or certain ways of winemaking. So the big question today is appellation, no appellation, yes, no, benefits, lots of questions around, do we think the appellation system is now redundant?
It's a really good question. I like the, you know, I remember when I was first discovering wine, so I kind of did what most people did, is like you learn about the famous places. And in the old world, in France in particular, because in the UK our wine education is very Franco-centric, it was very heavily appellation-led. You know, when you bought a bottle of wine, the main buying cue would be like Sancerre or Chablis or Côte du Rhône or many other appellations. And so that would be the main thing. So if you're a geek, you might know the producers. And obviously, producers are a very good cue for buying. But generally speaking, it was this shared collective brand of the appellation that was the thing you were supposed to choose the wine for. And the appellation rules were supposed to ensure that anybody buying a bottle of that wine would have a wine of a certain quality. So for instance, they specify the grape variety, obviously, they'd specify the you know, the way the vines were trained, even the yields that you could take, all manner of things would be specified in the regulations of the appellation, with the idea being that if you buy a bottle of wine with a certain name on the label, you will get a typical example and a certain guarantee of quality through that. You know, and then some appellations would have taste tests as well. So they'd filter out some wines they think didn't taste typical for the appellation. And on paper, this sounds great. But in practice, I think it's more complicated.
I agree. I mean, I think appellations were formed with a good idea. It was to ensure minimum standards, but actually, in a way, it sort of throttled innovation, and in a way, it was totally arbitrary. Who chooses what grape to grow on what soil? And in fact, a lot of appellations were illiterate, in the sense that they had no sense of the historical culture of particular wine regions. Like particularly, let's talk about Jura, for example, in that a lot of wines had to be declassified to Vin de France or Vin de Table at the time, simply because they were made with traditional grape varieties and not with the modern recognized grape varieties. So if appellation isn't defending history and culture, what the hell is it doing? The other, the worrying thing about appellation as well, is that it leads to increasing homogenization, because obviously, if you're insisting on certain standards and certain styles of wine to be typical of a region, that means wines which are more interesting, perhaps more innovative, more natural, for want of a better word, are considered to be atypical and therefore are not entitled to appellation. And there have been a lot of instances of growers falling out of appellation, and even whole appellations falling apart, particularly in the Loire, I'm afraid to say, where there's a battle between a group of growers who want their efforts to be recognised. One classic example is Anjou, in which it is said you could get appellation with a bottle of wine that costs less than a bottle of mineral water. But if you work biodynamically with horses and make a natural wine, then you get declassified because your wines are considered to be weird or funky or not typical. So, and this is not just Loire. This is Piedmont. We work with a grower, Stefano Bellotti, who, you know, RIP, by the way, whose wines were, again, thrown out of appellation because he had the temerity to plant peach trees in the vineyard, which again is a traditional sort of polycultural thing to do. It's been done for like hundreds of years, to plant sort of soft fruit trees and to have other plants within the vineyard. But again, it was, you know, not allowed by some arbitrary local rules. And as the man himself said, like, you know, when I make Garvey or I make Cortese, it must reflect the particularity of the vineyard. So that vineyard has maritime influences on that sort of soil, whatever. And my wines don't taste like a typical Garvey or a typical Cortese because they've all been homogenized by the fact that the board will only allow a style of wine that is recognized by consumers or consumer acceptance panels. Whereas when he asked what is a typical Garvey, they gave him a description of a wine that was so neutral that it was exactly the same description of a wine as a Verdicchio way down south. So what does it mean? If appellationism meant to be calling things and describing things the way they are, but has actually laid down like a whole bunch of, in some cases, largely arbitrary rules, which don't actually defend the region, they impose upon it and the region's growers, I should say.
I mean, it often can also be dictated for political reasons, right? Because some of these appellations are funded by, let's say, some of the larger producers who are making wines that maybe fit and a more generic
cooperatives as well, yes.
Profile. Yeah. So then it becomes very, very difficult because, there's a dominant force that's like guiding what that policy looks like for the appellation. And that doesn't necessarily help small artisan producers. The one that comes up for me as an example, actually, I'm thinking of is like the Carver appellation, like how that just has disintegrated for like quality Carver. And then the complexity of creating new appellations, which has become very confusing, because then it was like, is it Panetta's Classic? And then there's like Corpinat, and there's all of this stuff that for a consumer, nobody knows the head from their tail. Like in this situation, for me as a buyer, it's like, what's happening over there now? It's confusing how a winery should define themselves. Where do they fit in? How can it change? How do you see the innovation for the appellation system?
Let's look at the positives of an appellation system. And I think the positives, I think, are not without merit. I mean, the fact that, you know, once you've got a region that has identified a sort of talent that this region has, say, for instance, with a set of grape varieties, then to kind of restrict the appellation to working with those grape varieties kind of preserves a local identity in that sense. You know, if you look at, for instance, the New World wine regions, if we're still able to use that term New World, let's use the term outside of Europe wine regions. I mean, I grew up with Australian wine. That's how I got into wine. And I mean, going to Australia and you've got wineries there where, for the local market, they'll plant everything. You know, they'll plant 8 different varieties and make wines from them because the local market wants a Cabernet, they want a Shiraz, they want a Sauvignon Blanc, they want Chardonnay, they want Riesling. So you'll get all these different varieties being made in the same place, even though that place may have a certain talent for a certain variety or a few varieties. It's like commercial expediency means that they make everything. And I understand that, but it's like, so that's all well and good. But then the appellation system is a way of like saying, well, we'll stop focusing on things that we're not really good at. We'll just focus on things we're really good at, that our sites really work well with. And so in some ways, the appellation system has been very positive in preserving regional diversity and preserving styles of wines. And that's been good. But the problem with the collective brand is it requires everybody to be selfless and to try and work in favour of that collective brand. Well, the problem is, you know, looking on my shelves there, I see some Chablis, I see some Sancerre. You know, it's like, those are famous names, right?
And how many generic wines have you had from those places?
Exactly. So the people who make money out of Chablis, so the good producers are building equity into that collective brand. They're making wines that are really, truly worthy of the name Chablis, but then the people who make the money out of that collective brand are the people who can just pour out loads of wine that matches the appellation Cahier de Charge, but really has very little character. So the supermarkets are full of wines with the famous names on them, that just Chateauneuf du Pape, you know, all these names that are very disappointing examples, because they're the cheapest examples of the appellation, and that dilutes the appellation. And it's like, so some people are playing well, they're doing well, they're building equity into the brand. Other people are just spending that brand equity, because on an individual level, it costs them nothing. And so this is the big problem with appellations, is that you can't guarantee quality by a cahier de charge, you know, a set of rules. You know, it's almost like you have to recognize quality at the end. And there's different ways to get into quality. But by setting maximum yields and all these sorts of regulations, you know, that doesn't guarantee quality.
And so this is the big disappointment. What you can do is you can break it down a bit, because appellations are like ridiculously large, you know, like, I mean, terrain, for goodness sake. I mean, it's huge. I mean, there's probably thousands of growers within that whole appellation. There's no one identical style, but how are you to know?
But then we see things like Terrain Chenonceau and things like that, you know, it's like...
Yeah, so I think in France particularly, there was Minervois, AOC, 300 and something growers. Okay. Now there's La Lavinière and, you know, Corbière, it's Boutenac, and more subdivisions, each crew having higher and higher standards, and a sense that the growers are increasingly involved in defining the terroir, defining the standards, rather than some sort of arbitrary board and saying this is all good Corbière. In fact, Corbière is fine, but would you not want to have a crew status within it? Would you not want your particular estate and your particularly low yields and your adherence to local grape varieties recognized in appellation, rather than just like you're one of 350, 400 growers? I think there's another thing which is goes beyond appellation. A few years ago, Renaissance des Appellations was formed.
Nicolas Joly, biodynamic...
To protect the notion of appellation, and that's quite a worthy status. But they imposed far stricter standards, and they did like a one-star, two-star, three-star system. And they allied appellation to farming, organic, biodynamic, etc. You know, the amount, you know, like not filtering, or you know, not using certain sort of adjunctives in wine. And growers who wanted to go from one to two to three stars, I mean, they were designated, whatever they would do was being described, but they're all part of a group that was basically pushing each other harder and higher to make better wines. And therefore appellations being associated with quality, getting right-minded people, not just in one region, but across the whole of the world, to sort of create this notion of like, these are special places. The other sort of organizations are obviously organic and biodynamic. There are many, many, many bodies that certify. Again, usually imposing minimum standards to get the qualification. It's not a perfect system by any means, but it's a start. And all these things... together with appellation can make a difference. But at the moment, I think appellation in itself, although a worthy idea originally, as I said, is probably not fit for purpose at the moment.
I think what's coming up for me when you shared that, Doug, I started to think about, like, you know, like the appellation system is just like any other organization or association, that it's not void of the same complexities of gain and agenda that like everybody who's involved uses that system for their own advantage, right? Like, it's not just because it's wine, because we love it and we're passionate about it and we see it as, you know, something that is maybe a spiritual calling, maybe a poetic thing, maybe it's a form of art. But I think there's a lot of people in our business also where it is business. So it's actually sort of reflects the same interactions that you see in our own political systems. And it is, the appellation system is a bit political, right? Like, we can't, like, it's something that people do have to be active and engaged in, but equally it can be really hard to like incite change or for change to happen within the system, because of maybe the number of people that are set to
yeah.
win something out so of in, the way in, the status quo. Yeah,
in non-European wine regions, I've seen some interesting things with appellations. So Marlborough is a region that I know quite well in New Zealand. So Marlborough, there's all sorts of problems in the sense that, you know, this has become famous for Sauvignon Blanc. And most people play by the rules, but there's a whole bunch of people who kind of hoover up select grapes that are above yield cap or beyond rot threshold and sort of like make cheap Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc out of those and then use the name Marlborough yeah. to and flood the market with very cheap bulk wine that takes away from that collective brand of Marlborough. So there's a group of producers who've instituted this appellation Marlborough wine, including top people like Dog Point, a load of other people. And I think that's interesting. So it's almost like a self-regulating system where there's an evolution that takes place within the growers because they want to protect the name. So rather than using rules, they just form a club that then acts as a sort of like a quality standard there. And I think that you see in California, you see this emergence of AVAs. And a lot of, what you see is these broad AVAs and then this profusion of smaller AVAs with a view to increasing the price of the wines because they're from more tightly
smaller geographical space.
Yeah, yeah. And some of those appellations have been silly, like Sonoma Coast means nothing. But some are quite useful, like West Sonoma Coast is interesting.
Significant, actually.
Yeah, because Sonoma Coast is like huge. Yeah. But West Sonoma Coast, that's been very interesting. And Petaluma Gap, I think, has been quite interesting. Mm. And so I think Russian River Valley is a very diverse, maybe not the ideal sort of AVA, but within that, they've introduced this idea of neighbourhoods, which I think is clever. So people trying to produce really good quality wines are often working within the constraints of the system they're in. And often in these non-European wine countries, you'll see this almost like a move towards, it's almost like an unstoppable move towards a sort of appellation system. It's like you can't resist it. This is what people want to do. And some people have got good motivations because they believe that the wines from this appellation have a distinctive quality. Other people are like, just make it tighter, have an AVA, and then we'll be able to charge more for our wines. And I think the real test of the integrity of an AVA is whether you can back it up scientifically. Do the wines from this particular patch of land taste different? And I think in Argentina, the Gualtageri work, and there's another GI that they've got there, whose name escapes me, they've done some really good scientific work on establishing these GIs. So they look and see how can we logically, on the basis of geology and climate, delineate this GI, and then let's go from there. Whereas in England, there was a ridiculous Sussex PDO, which is basically the whole county of East and West Sussex,
which is
this is meaningless because this is within the Sussex PDO.
Someone could just write that anyway on the wine.
You've got some really great terroirs there. You've got some terrible terroirs. You should never plant grapes there. And it's like, whereas in Champagne, you look at Champagne, the appellation for Champagne delineates where in the whole Champagne region you can plant vineyards. It's only a few places within that whole area that you can plant vineyards and get the appellation. Whereas the Sussex one is ridiculous because you can plant vines anywhere in Sussex. As long as you can meet minimum must weights and a few other categories, it's like you get this Sussex PDO. And what it means is when people start getting PDOs or AVAs or appellations, it means that name is then protected. And then even if you exist in Sussex and you're making wine and you can't use that name if you're not meeting their particular criteria. And you might be making great wine, but that name has been taken away from everyone. You know, I think that's a big problem as well.
Is that not hiding behind the place, you know, the wider, the greater appellation? Now, this, I think, dovetail neatly into the next thing, which is people who come out of appellation and actually become, they're more famous than the appellation. You know, we've seen it with Super Tuscans, obviously. We see it a lot in the natural wine world, particularly. Sometimes it's because the person doesn't want to be confined by the rules, which are quite frankly, not strict enough or not precise enough to make great wines.
Or limiting.
Sometimes they're one of their wines or all of their wines are disallowed in a particular vintage. And then why would they want to receive appellation again after that, even if their wines are a bit more typical in another vintage? So bit by bit, we see a lot of particularly well-known growers deciding, oh, I might as well make a Vin de France. And I wonder if this is a bit more of a European thing, that we do, the sense that some independent vignerons don't feel the need to belong to the appellation, but to like-minded other vignerons who make the same sort of wines. I call it sort of mini globalization. It's the opposite of globalized style, which is about all about conformity. It's about individuals linking up in their quest for uniqueness and perfection, if you like. And, you know, I think there are so many great Vin de France's, Vino de Tavolas. I don't worry about appellation anymore. It doesn't guarantee it, me anything, but the grower and the way they work, these are the important things. But then as a consumer, you're using appellation as a sort of like a guarantee of minimum quality, but maybe you might be missing something by not ordering a Vino de Tavola or a Vin de France on a wine list.
I agree. And I think this could be the perfect segue into the first wine. I don't know if we're going to open the unblind wine or the blind wine.
Doug's got a blinder for us. So we're going to do the blinder first. Yeah.
It. Oof. Some sound effects as well.
So, is this white or red?
This is white. It's red, sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I love the way that Doug is saying, it's white. No, it's red. It's like, it's not a hard choice. It's like, it's kind of...
I live in a binary world.
I feel like I know this wine, and it's...
this is our first time on Just Another Wine podcast where we're tasting wine blind. And Emily and I are on the spot a little bit.
I know, we're totally on there. It's a lot of blueberries. Oh, so many blueberries. Yeah.
So what I'm getting those, I'm getting...
like it over here. Yeah.
I'm getting a little bit of this lovely spicy reductive character. I'm getting some tar and pepper, and then really aromatic red fruits mainly.
I get a lot of blueberry.
Cherry, violent. Raspberry... Yeah, violet, definitely.
They're like little fruits that you almost like bite into.
Yeah,
and
like
gush.
Wild berries. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, wild berries, basically.
And the palate is supple and sleek. It's fresh. It's like a low alcohol wine, I think. It's got this almost transparency. There's fruit there, but it's like it's not invasive fruit. It's subtle fruit. And there's this beautiful energy and flow on the palate.
If you didn't know what it was, and you don't know what it is, would you say, I think this wine... exemplifies typicity, whatever that means. I feel that it is true to what it is. It's not funky, it's not weird, it's like not supernatural. It could be recognized as a style in itself.
I think there's a sense of finesse and elegance and joy about this wine combined. It's like it's got some of the pleasure of Pinot Noir, but it's not Pinot Noir, I don't think. It's got this chalky, grainy structure underneath the
texture's
fruit.
Throwing me off this, like, the suppleness of it. It doesn't, like, Pinot Noir's a bit grippier,
no,
maybe.
But it's almost like there's a transparency and delicacy, and there's almost like a little bit of a hole in the mid-palate. Not a bad way, but there's, like, this gap. You go from the slightly bassy notes and the structure, and then you go gap and then treble.
Yes.
It's really interesting. I think this is a beautiful wine. I love it.
I'm wondering if it's vinifera or not, but the aromatics are beautiful. Like, it could be like Grollo or something, you know? Like something, I don't know, like Cabernet Franc. Or like,
Pinot Denise.
Denise, okay.
It has a firmness to it, which is interesting.
It's Pinot Denise like or Cabernet Franc, or it's Loire-like, I think. Yeah. Definitely Loire-like. I'm saying this with this degree of certainty that belies the fact that... Can be totally,
but there's something about the viscosity.
Well,
Loire
Luck
is
a sort of relative thing. It's
you
also
you have different corner.
No, but I agree. But there,
or it could be Spanish,
about,
New Spain.
Yeah, it could be because the viscosity is throwing me off. There's like a density to this, like this softness. It doesn't feel I don't know. Again, it's, I'm like wondering.
If you had to rewind what we were talking about in a previous episode and describe what soil. You feel the soil type is, and I don't mean like don't say the soil type, whatever, but the way it feels in your mouth in terms of the texture. I think Jamie got pretty close. He said chalky. There is a sort of crunchy, like, you know, like putting some pebbles in your mouth sort of element to the spine.
It's a freshness, and it's almost like it's not high acid, but it's got that limestone feel around the edge of the mouth. It's got definitely like a tangy, limestone-y. Like you feel it on the edge of the tongue a bit, yeah?
And the aftertaste, I think.
But I'd say it's a warm climate wine.
From the Loire.
From limestone. From limestone, made in a really sympathetic way, so that it's like it's picked early, but you get the generosity in the mid palate, you get the silkiness, but then you get this lovely textural element.
I mean, it could be, I mean, most limestone anyway is like clay limestone as well, right? Like it could be.
So could it even be from, could it be from Bourgogne? Could it be from Burgundy?
What, and like a natural producer, maybe? It could be, like, because it's, but like maybe northern, like more northern. Like it could be because of that sort of blue-black fruit that's there.
Yeah.
Marsanais or Côte d'Auxerre or something like that. Mm. Or it's going to be something annoying like a red wine from Champagne.
It's not Gamay.
Dear listener, you can't tell, but my facial expression is perfectly blank at the moment.
He's got his poker face on.
Yes.
And Doug plays a lot of
can
poker,
you pour
by
us
the
some
way.
More?
Doug makes half his salary from poker.
I play with wine corks, not the real.
He's got his own ring. Go on. Can I have a little bit more of that?
Of course you can. Yeah.
It's a very pleasurable wine anyway. We're really enjoying it.
It is.
Here we go.
But I think I feel...
Yes.
I think I feel European.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I could be anywhere from like Bourgogne to Spain. I don't think it's a Garnacha.
I think it's limestone.
I'm thinking limestone generally.
Yeah, I mean then
it's not got that brightness of. It's got a different sort of brightness. The brightness of.
But the heat's not there, right? Because then I went to my head. I was like, could it be like Monsanto or something? And then I was like, but it doesn't feel like it has the weight of that either.
No, not Ribera Sacra, not...
Yeah, somewhere in Galicia, but then there's...
No.
I don't know where there's limestone there.
Maybe it's not limestone, but it's beautiful and ethereal and quite delightful.
It could be a dark grape and light terroir, or it could be a light grape and dark terroir. So, you know, it's that sort of, like, fun balance.
I still think Pinot Donis for me. That's
Do
got
you?
That, yeah, it's got that sort of...
There's a certain pepperiness to it, which is like...
I don't think it's Pinot Denise, but I am... Okay, could I... I'd like a moment. We'll have to... A dark grey...
So beautifully textural. Oh.
And this glass, the perfume, really. It's lifting out.
Doug is tasting from the Zolto Bordeaux glass, I think.
Oh, it must be a Bordeaux then.
No. Is it a Bordeaux glass? And Emily and I are drinking from the Zolto Universal.
Yeah, but also with this, like, there's still some tannin there, actually.
Yeah. It's quite grainy and tannic, isn't it? Yeah.
But you know, like, sometimes Cabernet Franc has that Pinot Noir expression, right? It's not quite as vegetal as maybe you might expect, but if you think of, like...
Or could it even be Malbec from the Loire.
And if he's given us a... Yeah, that's actually... What a cot.
Yes.
I feel like sometimes they're a bit more wild, though. But, like, actually, the violety note...
Yeah, the violety note, it could well be something like Malbec. Malbec tends to have maybe higher acidity and less tannin, believe it or not, because Malbec, not all Malbec, isn't Argentinian. I mean, I would say look at the sort of... I think there's a certain, again, verticality to the wine, the lift of it.
So we're talking about granite then, are we?
Could be.
Might have missed it.
Yeah, but then where are we? I think maybe I got a bit stuck with...
When you're blind tasting, will we stick with your first impressions?
Maybe it's Beaujolais.
Oh, you're sort of backtracking now. So
let's do the reveal, Doug.
We've
done a lot of guessing around this.
Yes.
I'm quite excited to see what this is. Take the sock off. It's quite a nice sock.
So, Sompere means without compare. It's a wine from Le Bruges, which is Savoie. It's actually right next to
Belois
Vineyard. Mondeuse and Etrea de la Doye, which is like a really rare local grape.
Mondeuse, of course.
And Mondeuse has a very particular character.
Yeah.
But Etrea de la Doye has quite a lot of tannin.
Was this you going Mondeuse, back to the Grange conversation that we should be remembering that?
I was cluing you in.
No, but Doug, this is a remarkable wine.
Yeah.
So Etrea de la Doye is a variety, yeah?
Yes, a very rare Savoie.
This is a variety. Beautiful, beautiful wine. Thank you for sharing this.
Thank you.
We're in
the Haute Savoie. We're on limestone scree.
Behind it with a bit of grains and whatever.
So the limestone bit is right because it gives the sort of finesse that you talked about.
I think the Loire's the best.
There's a grip from Mondeuse, which is quite a powerful tannic grape variety as well. But we tend to think of it as like a Jura grape variety. It isn't at all. Mondeuse can be...
I think of it more Rhone-y almost.
The theory is a guy that comes from Northern Italy or the Rhone, or it's certainly sort of related to other quite darker grape varieties, and yet it has the freshness of, I would say, mountain terroir. It's Le Bruges, so it's not a it's not an Appellation wine, it's an IGP.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because I think that Mondeuse often, for me, has this almost rich, chocolatey, ripe character, and this has brought this into restraint and balance, but you're getting that sort of sweet core fruit that means it's very hard to place anywhere else. That we were struggling to place this.
He says this is Mondeuse, then I can be like, yes, okay, that makes sense in the framework of my very limited experience of trying Mondeuse. But it's not a great variety that I feel that I could necessarily pick blind, because it's always got somewhere between this gamay.
What retail price would this be?
Retail 28-30.
That's fantastic. That's very good.
It's made in terracotta.
That's jars. Interesting. Because almost like you can.
Yeah, that chalkiness.
That's
as
the
well
suppleness.
That.
You can sense the eggs. I really think this is a sensational wine.
And biodynamic farming, but only 5 years old, the vines, so replanted. So I almost wanted to show this during our sort of terroir class and say, so much distinctive personality in such a short space of time. And why? Because biodynamic farming, like low yields, hands-on, and a winemaking style that just lets, you know, it's not forcing it, it's not pressing it, just lets the juice express itself. And I think it does it beautifully.
It's a really great wine. I think actually the Loire guess is maybe as close as you can get to it because of the limestone, but... Yeah, I couldn't place it. I was just like, it can't be Cabernet Franc, but it feels too polished, it feels too viscous, it feels too dense. But then it was like, Grollo, it's not wild enough. It was really hard to place, but really a very interesting wine to try blind without any preconceptions of the varietal as well.
Because
I think, especially for me, when I don't know a grape variety very well, and I've only had a few examples, it's much easier to make assumptions about it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, I mean, it's a blend as well, I suppose, but it's very naked. There's nothing added. It's a natural wine. And yet it feels like quite straight in terms of the, you know, there's no funkiness, no edges, no raw element to it. It's very pure.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for putting us on the spot on camera, but... on
microphone.
Yeah, on mic.
So let's move on to the second wine we've chosen for this episode, which is actually probably not many bottles of this still survive. It's the debut vintage of Matassa, and this is Tom Lobby when he was still involved with Sam Harrop then, actually. This is a 2002 vintage when they made just one wine. It's 12.5% alcohol. Old vines and... 500 meters of altitude, and I believe this is a varietal Carignan.
It is.
And I bought 6 bottles of this from Sam for €15 each. Or was it £15 each? I remember.
I don't know. Were you living in France?
No, when I first got to know.
Are we part of the EU then?
Yeah.
So I think it was a more
inclusive time when we could easily.
But so what's interesting about this is actually a vin de table, and so the vintage and grape variety aren't declared on the bottle or the label. Although it does say on the back that 15 months of élevage bottled in 2003. So you can work back from that to the vintage. But this is an interesting thing, this whole notion of stepping outside appellations. In the past, you really got punished for it. Like Vin de France, you couldn't talk about vintage or grape variety. But now I think that the rules have relaxed to the point that you can actually mention the grape variety and the vintage on the label for Vin de France. Which I think is a positive thing. It's like it's recognising that some people might want to choose to work in a place, but without adhering to the rules of the place. And then they have the choice to do that, but they're not handicapped to the point that their wines are unsellable because they can't put any information on them.
Yeah. I'm sure Tom told me an interesting story about the village in which this comes from, which is Caus in the Roussillon. And he said that one day the mayor called all the local growers together. And this is like a hotbed of brilliance and innovation. I mean, all this sort of like, it's got some of the most incredible terroir, like schistus and old vines. My God, old vines. Mm. And the mayor said excitedly, "I've got some great news. We're grubbing up the last of the 150-year-old Grenache Gris vines," and all the growers looked aghast. He said, "Yeah, no, we're going to plant Cabernet Sauvignon instead." And it made me think that Carignan, years ago, some very famous wine writers who should know better called Carignan the ugly duckling grape variety. Only
was that Jamie Good?
No, Jamie Good was not one of these. No, it was someone even. Say more famous, but anyway, you'd know.
We know.
And there was more than one wine writer. Got to say that. So Carignan was a workhorse grape variety. It was only fit for blending. It was only fit for cheap wines, and yet, like over the years, it's been proved that Carignan is one of the most appropriate grape varieties for the Languedoc Roussillon. It thrives on old schistous, sort of slaty soils. And when you've got 120, 130-year-old vines, which have survived all sorts, why would you rip them out? Just because Syrah is, for example, a more fashionable grape variety of Cabernet Sauvignon. It turned out that Syrah, particularly in the Languedoc, was only good for blending, only good for being part of a blend, and that Carignan should really dominate on the particular terroir of the Languedoc Roussillon. And probably about 10 years hence, it was then realised that Carignan was actually a really good grape variety and could make world-class wines. But the snobbery, and again, it's an appellation thing, saying this wine, you know, should have a maximum 30% Carignan or 40% Carignan, you know, is crazy, because what's going to happen in the end? You have to change it. And if you change it, like, what price appellation if it's constantly changing? Well, it's probably a good idea that it does.
Well, no, I quite appreciate some appellations have shown flexibility, like Chianti Classico used to be like, you couldn't be Chianti Classico if you're 100% Sangiovese. And that changed a few years back for the better, I think, which means that you bring more of the top producers into the fold. You know, ultimately, you don't mind if some people are going IGT Toscana for some wines in their range, but you really want them to be focusing on, you know, building into that collective, you know, brand equity of Chianti Classico. The top producers, the most ambitious people, and often they're the ones that would have gone 100% Sangiovese.
And should we talk about this wine now, though?
Yes, because I think this is actually really interesting, because this is a wine that I bought 20 years ago, and it hasn't been stored in totally ideal conditions all the way, but it's still really good.
Yeah.
This is like a and this is obviously Tom's style would have changed a little bit since then. I think this, for me, this has shown you a slightly high extraction, more traditional winemaking style back in 2002. And you've got a little reduction here in this wine still. It is a 20-year-old wine, but it's got some reductive qualities, but also it's got fruits.
Maybe still. Also to its benefit, no? As well, for its longevity.
I'm getting this slightly reductive. It's a development on the nose, but this is an amazing colour and amazing fruit intensity still. This is like a... This is Grand Cru, I think.
There's getting some nice... Yeah. Like the umami is there, but it's not dominating. And there's still structure. There's still acidity. There's still some tannin there that's like quite intriguing where I'm like, oh, I actually want to drink this.
I think what you really have here is a phenomenal terroir. And then like old vines and... a great variety, which is highly underrated and does have the capacity to age really well. We've had we've had on our list like 15, 20, 30-year-old Carignan. And it's a sort of wonderful thing. It doesn't sort of oxidize as maybe some grape varieties might, like Grenache. You know, it keeps its structure.
Not expecting it to be this fresh and focused, and it's got development in a nice way, but it's still very much alive. There's some tannin here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Tom, you know, Tom is quite the anarchist as well, right? Like we talked about that earlier. But, you know, he's quite a strong character. And I really can't imagine a world where he adheres to other people's rules, right? Like I think he is somebody that wants to captain his own ship. And he wants to be able to guide that ship on the route that he wants to take it on. And I think... This is one of the benefits of stepping outside of the appellation system, is not having to adhere to these rules, just really like leaning into your expression of the land that you're working with, and not being held back by, do I need to think about, am I going to achieve the right ripeness or the right ABV to be able to deliver that? Do I need to age it for X amount of months? Because actually, if you're working with maybe the viewpoint of stewardship, not just from a farming perspective, but also from a winemaking perspective, and you want to guide that wine along on your interpretation of what that journey of the wine should look like, some of those sets of rules don't always make sense every year. It could get stickier in the coming years. It's like, what happens now with climate chaos? How is it going to be when we get these more radical shifts in weather patterns, which are going to dictate completely different levels of alcohol, acidity, fruit expression, all of this sort of stuff. Like, if you have to produce a wine that's this amount, this percentage, that tastes a bit like this, like, we're going to start to see different expressions and different identities from these places.
I think we already are, though.
And but, like, yeah, but is the appellation system flexible enough to allow it?
No, it's going to collapse. It's going to collapse.
No, because it can. But also, like, think of all the individual... I mean, how many individuals make wine in a certain appellation? But they all have different tastes, don't they? Like, are they making wine to conform to the appellation? Or, like, Tom, is what he loves to drink influencing the way he makes wine? So I would suggest that Tom loves Austrian wines. He loves... wines from the Jura, probably. And I'm also thinking that Austrian growers in the Burgenland go to the Jura and pay homage to the wines, the whites and the reds. And this so influences the way they make wine. So they go completely against what their parents and what the appellation does. But they think it's the right way to go because the wine is the reflection of your personality and your preferences. Why be hidebound by appellation? They may still make some wines to conform to appellation, but this is not what they feel wine is about. So I think Tom, over the years, I mean, you may taste his red wines. They're light, they're fresh, they're incredibly low in alcohol. You know, they're very pretty, they're floral. You know, they don't necessarily make you think, oh, well, that's what Roussillon is or used to be. But maybe this is what Roussillon will be. Maybe a lot of people in the region are thinking, you know what, I want to make a wine that I drink myself and enjoy, and there's a bit of pleasure in it. I'm going to change the way I make wine. I may go for whole cluster fermentations. I may go semi-carbonic. We've seen a lot of that in the Languedoc Roussillon. that winemaking methods are changing. We may harvest earlier. We may harvest on taste rather than ripeness. I think this is like true all over the world. I don't think people are now thinking like, I'm going to make a wine typical of AOC Roussillon.
No, when I taste Matassa, I think, this tastes like Matassa.
Yes, that's what I
think. So I think there's a big issue coming, which is that once a name has been chosen as an appellation, it takes that name out of circulation. So you can't say where you made the wine from. And a lot of wines that skip the appellation, for the consumer, it's like, well, where does this come from? They can't say where it comes from because that name is protected now by, you know, the PDO regulations. And I think that's a big problem. I think this is increasingly a problem as we enter into this time of, you know, having to revise things because of climate chaos and this warming trend. And regions that have traditionally been fixated on certain varieties, those varieties may no longer be a faithful lens with which to interpret those terroirs. And so people playing with other varieties, they can't use the name of the place. So it's like you've got this big problem coming up, which is that, you know, realistically, we've got to think about revising the set of varieties we use. And also in terms of sustainability, this is another discussion. It's like Vitis vinifera is susceptible to diseases that mean you need to spray a lot of times every year.
Mm.
That's not super sustainable. And now we have a raft of resistant varieties, the Restio Peewee varieties that are coming through, that have the potential to make really interesting wines. But unless they get the appellation, it's like people are taking a hit financially by growing those varieties because they don't get the appellation, so they have to sell them at a lower price.
And we need the experience and the time to actually see how they perform. Yeah. And that's not going to happen unless there's enough buy-in from enough growers to even see if they actually make that.
Not having the appellation is a big disincentive for many growers, because if you're selling grapes, for instance, and we've got to recognise that a lot of regions, there's a grower culture where people grow and then sell grapes. If they don't get the appellation, that they take a big financial hit. So this is like we're seeing a revolution in vineyards, because we have to have a revolution, because, you know, in the light of climate chaos and warming trends and increased disease pressure, it's simply not sustainable in some regions to be growing Vitis vinifera for basic wines, you know, where you can't take the care, you know, that you need to because economics don't allow it. So we need to start thinking about how the appellations evolve. Do we still need them? I mean, there's so many things that's good about them, but they're so restrictive as well.
And also, can I just throw a little extra cherry on top of the cake on that? Hmm. What happens now with climate chaos in regions that are now no longer suitable for producing wine, and those people are farming grapes? How do we form new appellations and relocate those people?
Well,
because that's something that's also going to become a topic.
You have to remember that one of the problems with appellations is there was a vogue, let's say in the Languedoc, for example, to plant Syrah when it was not appropriate climate for Syrah, you know, because it ripened to like 14.5, 15%. So now there's a vogue to plant the original grapes of the region. Picpoul Noir is a classic example.
Yeah.
And other grapes, Terreira.
And also we're seeing a rediscovery of grape varieties, because with Phylloxera, there's a bottleneck. So Phylloxera in the late 19th, early 20th century meant that lots of vineyards got abandoned,
yes,
but also lots of varieties got abandoned then as well. And so, like, Playmont, a co-op in Saint-Marc,
yeah, we know. Yep.
Done some really good things.
He imports the wines.
Done some really,
the Mad Saint Noir.
Yeah, done some really good things, rediscovering varieties from the past that were discarded because they didn't get ripe enough, but now they're perfect. Who knows?
But also the nurseries are now sort of planting out these things because they realise that, you know, if a grape variety ripens at 10.5%, you just blend it with some of these other things. So it's an interim measure.
Nature's alcohol reduction.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Blending is a really good way of doing it. Gives you chance also to then to replant, you know, maybe north-facing vineyards, different part of the appellation or the region. But the appellation doesn't pivot quickly enough to sort of recognise the pressures that are upon it. Yeah, climate crisis is a major pressure. So how quickly can you convert and turn things around? Maybe 3 or 4 years, if you're lucky. but you can start making, start the process of making different wines pretty soon.
I mean, it's interesting to me, Bordeaux, for example, right? Because especially as somebody who really tries to champion artisan producers, and I'm quite, I lean, let's say, left in the wine world into quite a lot of natural wines, but I don't make myself dogmatic about it. But still, I'm often a little bit sceptical sometimes around the Bordeaux model that's so widely spreadly used, that, or widespread use of it. Of often you go to a lot of cellars and the winemaking and the vessels and everything is very formulaic and often quite similar to the neighbours. And the wines are very designed to be appealing to, let's say, a wider audience palate. For me, when I've been to Bordeaux, often it feels a little bit like going to Disneyland for wine drinkers, just in terms of how it feels energy-wise. But then for that region to be one of the most innovative in terms of considering climate change and climate chaos to permit completely new varietals into the appellation system, I think is kind of very fascinating for me. And
well, the strength they have is their blends. So suddenly, if Bordeaux is in much better shape facing climate chaos than Burgundy.
But still, we're going to use Albarino all of a sudden, right?
Like, Nacional.
Yeah, like
and some just, hybrids as well.
And just bring it in. It's just like, I think that's kind of cool. And I think this same flexibility would be an amazing tool for other appellations to actually consider, what are we doing here? Does this make sense? How do we incentivize that? And obviously, again, it all like comes back to that same thing of like policy, EU support, you know, like how does that change?
But I think around the margins, it's like for super interesting wines made by committed growers, if they go off-grid, they go IGP or they go Vin de France, that's kind of cool. We're good with that because we follow those wines not because of the appellations. But for the mainstream wine industry, I think what would be really helpful would be to have people in charge of those appellations who are forward-thinking, open-minded, because if we can resurrect appellations, make them more flexible, make them more fit for purpose, that's good for everyone in the wine world. And one thing I was thinking of was I spent quite a bit of time in Canada.
Yeah.
And in Ontario, the VQA system. Yeah. And that's problematic because if you don't pass the taste test for the VQA, which is like buyers, basically it can't be producers. So it's kind of buyers for the LCBO who do the taste test. And you've got this young wine region that's developing and evolving. And you have the power of these taste testers to decide your wine isn't typical. And there's some very notable producers who've suffered from this. Now in Europe, you could just declassify and sell your wine still. But in Canada, there's a big tax break if you're in the VQA. So basically, the fact that some junior people at the LCBO are tasting your wines and saying they're not typical, even though this is a very young region, who knows what's typical for Niagara, is problematic because it costs the producers quite a lot of money if they fail the VQA. So I think that's an appellation system that needs more flexibility. I love the fact that VQA exists because it's good, because you have to differentiate between wines that are made from Canadian grown grapes, and in Canada they have this thing which is in cellared in Canada, international Canadian blends, where they have famous Canadian brands with wines on the shelves in the LCBO, which is like 25% Niagara grapes and 75% bulk imported wines that looks exactly like Canadian wines, has a Canadian name on the label. And I think that's a problem for that industry that they've got to face, you know. So VQA is very helpful in differentiating the wines that are uniquely Canadian from these weird blends.
So we're saying that appellation should be stricter but fairer at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Mm. I think that the appellations are great. We've grown up with them. We still venerate them. They're still useful. They carry a sense of locality. And also they help to enshrine this notion of terroir, which we love so much. So there's so much going for them. It's just like there's so many miscarriages of justice that I think rankle with us as wine lovers. It's like, guys, come on. And that happens when people start being political and mean. So if people...
Or individualistic, right? When it's self-serving.
Well, isn't the strength of an appellation the diversity of styles? Yep. The fact that it accommodate so many individuals and yet still be within the appellation? Because they're just expressing different aspects of terroir and making different decisions, as winemakers always do.
But there have to be limits. So there's a producer, I'm not sure we can talk about him anymore, from the Loire Valley, who's working in Sancerre. Those wines were like, I really liked those wines, but I thought having Sancerre on the label was a problem. Because
but we can use a different producer. We can use Alexander Bann, for example.
Same also, idea, yes.
No, but the idea is that in some ways it's like you don't... No, this producer still had the appellation, right?
Oh, yeah.
But and I thought there was a problem there, because if you're looking for a Sancerre and you come across the unnamed producer's wines, it's like this is not going to meet your expectations of a Sancerre. So the brand promise... of Sancerre is broken there. So in some ways, those wines are better out of the appellation. It's like IGT, or IGP.
IGP, no.
Yeah. I think because they're not, it's like for a normal person going to a restaurant, ordering a Sancerre, gets one of these unnamed wines, that's going to be problematic. Unless the sommelier says, you must realise that you know what you're ordering, you know. So I think that there has to be that level of, like, once you put an appellation on the label, it's a brand promise. So try to meet that brand promise.
But don't you think some of these individuals would do it pour and corriger les autres? You know, like, as to say, okay, if my wine can get in, like, maybe more people will be a bit more adventurous. I mean, it's no coincidence that Sancerre and Puy-Fumé are probably two of the most conservative appellations in the whole of France. And the wines... are so much of a style that it's as if like no one could express themselves.
It's very sterile.
And the farming is sterile and the winemaking is sterile. So someone does completely the opposite in every regard. Are they pushing the envelope or are they taking the mickey?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not taking the mickey. This is what they believe. But, I mean, Jamie's right in the sense that, you know, if I gave that wine to someone, they would be shocked.
Yes.
And shockers can be good because it jolts you awake, but it's also bad because you're probably not going to want to drink it if you ordered a Sancerre because you believed it was going to be.
Because you wanted a slightly neutral,
slightly tangy, aromatic.
So bearing in mind the limited time we have left available, how do we wrap this up? We've had so many interesting discussions with lots of threads weaving through it, as usual.
Yeah.
So how do we conclude this? Do we think... Maybe we should have a little vote. Who thinks appellations, on the whole, are a good thing and should be preserved? Who thinks they should be scrapped? So those who vote for preserving appellations, raise your hand now. Oh, it's just one. It's just one. It's me.
I'm going to put my hand to both.
Two cheers for democracy.
Doug, you're against scrapping it.
I'm against.
If I had to pick one,
I find that appellations breed.
If you're going to side with anyone, you side with Doug. I understand that.
No, I just. I actually would raise my hand to both questions because I don't think it's a binary answer. I actually think they serve a place, but they don't serve the only place.
No.
There should be room for both.
I think there's room for appellation wine, there's room for high quality wine that's non appellation wine. And it's like we need to find a way to coexist without
suggesting that
it's
about
lower quality if it's not in the appellation.
No, and also about it not being about bureaucracy, right? Which is so much what it's about.
I think you've said it there. This is my problem.
If people behave well and they performed well and they were good humans and they were open-minded, then the appellations have worked fantastically. Problem is that people get political and they're silly.
But I think bureaucracy generates conformity, and I'm, you know, like as a anti-authoritarian, I'm very much against like people having to fill in forms and prove that what they do is right when what they do is right. I can see from the point of view of consumers that appellation is a very useful thing because it starts them on the right journey, and it may not be reliable, but it could improve. There is room for improvement there, but instinctively, intuitively, I think appellation is a flawed system.
Agreed.
And I think of it from the point of view of the growers who want to express the best of what they can do.
Yeah, because for you and me, the three of us, we don't need the appellation system at all. But there's a lot of people that are like just going into places like, I'm trying to find something I can grasp onto. Like, what the hell does all of this mean?
The fact is that it's I know there's a lot of wine producers who are using that fact to just like scam people by making terrible wines with a famous appellation on the label. And it's the biggest scam in wine. You know, it's so disappointing that people will think, you know, I've heard of this famous appellation, Chablis. I want to try a Chablis. You buy a Chablis. If you don't know what you're buying, you're going to buy something quite disappointing.
The unofficial answer is we're all in favour of not having an appellation system.
It was clear to me the other day, I always felt this, when Smelly asked me for a Garvey de Garvey, and I said, we've got a Garvey. It's got to be Garvey de Garvey. And I said, so good they named it twice, almost. No. I said, what is that? Like a superior appellation? It's just like a brand marketing sort of thing? Yeah, I'm sure there are good wines in Garvey de Garvey, but there's amazing wines in Garvey. So what's the big idea? And I think when we come down to like the marketing element is defining what the appellation is, it's sort of like it's losing the point of the wine, I think.
I think we can't finish it any better than that,
yeah,
right?
Thank you, Doug. Yeah.
This is so really so, good. This so, is such so, a good so conversation
great.
Also tonight.
So great to be in the presence of Doug, yeah? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm good at finishing things, apparently.
Including bottles of wine.
Parties.
Parties.
Thank you to you both. That was a brilliant conversation and looking forward to the next one.
Thank you.
Go on.
And should you choose to follow us more, then you can find us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast. That's all one word.
That's correct. I'm Emily Harmon. Thank you.
I'm Jamie Good.
And I'm Doug Gregg.
Until next time.
Cheers.
Cheers.